Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Sickle, the stories-based podcast that interviews donors, thought leaders, and professionals in the field of fundraising.
I hope everyone had a great holiday weekend. I know I really enjoyed unplugging, spending time with friends, and taking a break. I'm excited for the fall season as we close out the summer and also season 8. This week, I chat with Leah Burton, the Deputy Director and Chief Advancement Officer at the Guggenheim. It's been a little while since we've had an arts and culture leader here, and we have a very fascinating conversation about the Guggenheim's pandemic response, how Leah has handled times of crisis, the museum's plan for the future, and we learn about Leah's background and personal journey near the end of the conversation. I used a quote from Leah to title the episode, "A Circle in a World of Squares." This is talking about the museum itself, but I also like the idea of being different and thinking outside of the proverbial box, pun intended. Leah joined the Guggenheim in September of 2019. She oversees the planning, management, and execution of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum and Foundation's strategic engagement with current and prospective donors regionally, nationally, and internationally. Burton comes to the Guggenheim from CCS Fundraising, a strategic consulting firm where, as vice president, she advised nonprofit clients in the art and culture, higher education, healthcare, and social services sectors. Prior to the Guggenheim, she worked at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in New York, where she oversaw fundraising initiatives for the greater New York and New Jersey area in support of the hospital. She previously was the director of development for St. Mary's Healthcare System for Children. She serves as an adjunct faculty member at Columbia University in the Master of Nonprofit Management program. She graduated from Knox College and received her Master of Science in Nonprofit Management with a focus on fundraising from Columbia University. A member of the Columbia University School of Professional Studies Alumni Council, Burton is also a member of the Association of Fundraising Professionals New York City and received National Young Professional of the Year Award from AFP. Now let's get started.
Hey listeners, it's Keith from Evertrue. Evertrue is the end-to-end solution for insight, outreach, and analytics for higher ed advancement and stewardship teams around the world. Recently, we launched Evertrue Studios, advancement's very first media hub, where subscribers have access to over 100 hours of free, on-demand original series and podcasts, all created with fundraisers in mind. We're thrilled to feature the Development Debrief on Evertrue Studios podcast network. Check us out at evertrue.com/studios.
Hi, Leah. Welcome to the Debrief.
Hi, Catherine. It's such a pleasure to be with you today.
I was excited to learn that 8 is your lucky number since this is the 8th episode of season 8.
Yes, absolutely. It's very fortuitous that it worked out numerically. As fundraisers, we love when our numbers work out. And this is just another example of that.
I'd like to start our conversation talking about how you've been leading the Guggenheim's development team over the last 3 years. As we all know, so much has happened, highs, lows, everything in between. Tell us what you've learned. I know that's such an open-ended question, but I'm sure you went through some very specific challenges.
I have learned more in the last 3 years than any other period of time. And I'm glad you asked this question. And you know, I joined in my role as Chief Advancement Officer and Deputy Director at the museum officially 6 months prior to having to close the museum in March of 2020. So I had built this very beautiful strategy and immediately realized that we would not be able to, you know, move forward with that and ripped it up. And one of the big things that I've realized is that leaders have to make extraordinarily difficult decisions in moments of crisis. And that's something that stuck with me. And sometimes it will be easily understood and easily palatable. And other times it's going to be quite difficult, but it's for the best interest of the institution that you are leading. One of the things that I learned as well, and I got this great advice from the museum director, as we had crisis upon crisis really hitting the museum at one point, is as a leader, there will always be some sort of crisis or serious issue that you're navigating. Maybe it's not at the magnitude of a pandemic and what we collectively experienced here at the museum in 2020 and are still dealing with day to day, But these moments will really define you as a leader, and you need to be okay with living in and living through these very challenging periods, because these help you grow. You'll be able to look to these challenging moments and reflect upon them when you're put in your next challenging situation. You know, big picture strategic thinking is critical for any leader, married with this idea of sort of the day-to-day management and thinking about this incremental domino effect and many moving pieces that you have to manage both internally as well as externally as a fundraiser. At the same moment where I was looking at every way in which I could support my team internally, going through everything, especially the New York City experience during the early days of the pandemic, we also had to think about shifting our narrative and case and how we're speaking with and working with our external audiences and donors and patrons being paramount to that work.
And was the internal or the external harder?
I would say the internal. Interesting. I would say the internal. You know, the external constituents that we work with very much understood the pivots that needed to happen. You know, like so many organizations went to donors who had, you know, restricted gifts for certain initiatives, who then released the restrictions so that we could use them for operating purposes. We looked at, you know, diversifying contributed revenue across different donor groups, doing emergency fundraising, you know, all that we saw across the board. We also took a pause for a moment and really reflected on what is the role of an arts and culture organization at this moment in time during the pandemic, and how do we support our local community? The Guggenheim itself is a constellation of museums. We have the museum here in New York on Fifth Avenue, but we also had a museum community in Venice, Italy, that was also very seriously struck by the pandemic in the early days and everything that Italy experienced. We have a museum in Bilbao, Spain, and we were getting ready to move to the final stages of, you know, announcing a museum beginning to be built in Abu Dhabi. So it was a really critical moment in all of these various locations. And I think the thing that I learned above and beyond everything is just how resilient the team at the museum is, how incredible of colleagues, particularly my team. You know, I work with them day to day, but, you know, we have a team that shows up for people personally as well as professionally. And I'm so proud of that.
Huge.
Yeah.
And you said you learned that you really had to make hard decisions. What was the hardest call you had to make?
We had to make staffing changes at the museum and reductions. And I think that is never the path that any leader wants to go down. And my team was not immune to those changes, but we had a shifting business model. You know, think about for-profit industry and how much they were affected. I mean, you still see the airline industry living through, you know, very painful moments today that were caused by the pandemic. And the same goes for nonprofits. You know, even as skilled of strategic organizations that are out there, you know, you still have to make difficult decisions for the operating model of your organization. And having to make reductions in staff was painful, very difficult, but, you know, necessary at that moment so that there was a Guggenheim that emerged, you know,
yeah,
at the moment when we were able to reopen our museum.
And looking back as you reflect, what do you think was one of the best decisions that you made?
Yeah, I think like most organizations, we were able to nimbly pivot to digital. And I think this is something that as a brick and mortar museum, we recognize the importance. And we've been making investments in digital prior to the pandemic. It just accelerated a lot of our work and strategy in our, you know, overall digital infrastructure, as well as, you know, thinking about how we're using digital potentially as our fifth constellation now, and that we could reach people who may never set foot inside the museum, but we could also connect our workforce, and we could make a better, you know, on-site experience through digital ticket purchasing and information sharing, as well as, you know, thinking about how we're, you know, telling the Guggenheim story across our various audiences. So I think this adoption of digital, you know, we're still learning, but I will say I've talked with a lot of my peers and I'm proud that the work that the museum was able to do. You hear the Guggenheim, you think this behemoth of an organization, but we're rather mid-sized. And that makes us quite nimble, which I think is a huge benefit. You know, we're able to quickly deploy things. And, you know, I think there's a lack of bureaucracy that maybe some other large scale institutions might experience.
I think of a bowl of spaghetti.
Yeah. I coined a term when I was working as a consultant that never really took off, maybe just internally, but we're a circle in a world of squares.
Ooh,
think about this.
I love
not to offend our peers. I love all of our peer, you know, museums, but I think the Guggenheim, you know, we are known equal parts for the art on the walls and installed at the museum during various times as we are for the architecture in New York, the beautiful palazzo we have in Venice, and now the two Frank Gehry buildings will have the one in Bilbao, which will celebrate its 25th anniversary this fall, and then the one that's being built in Abu Dhabi.
When you say that you went digital, can you just give us a couple of examples of what that meant and how that affected the donor work?
We were able to quickly deploy a lot of our programs for donors, right? Where we would otherwise be bringing people into the museum or to artist studios to a digital format where we're still able to have those same conversations and dialogues and learning and sharing of scholarship, but that it's done from the safety of your home when you're unable to travel and be at the museum. I think the other piece in the first team that went fully digital, and I give them tremendous credit because it was really heroic work, was our education department. And so they moved all of their education programs digitally. And most notably, we have an amazing program in New York City Public Schools. It celebrated its 50th anniversary, actually, in 2020, our Learning Through Art program. And we provide arts curriculum for schools who otherwise would not have, you know, access to arts education because of significant cuts in their budget. And so we were able to deploy that then online. And you can imagine how important that was for students living through this very, very trying period. We also, you know, were able to deploy education programs internationally and reach countries and audiences that, you know, we had not seen high visitation from. And we're able to take our access programs digitally as well, which was huge kudos to our access and interpretation team for being able to do that. We learned a lot, you know, the first iterations were never smooth, but I think we've taken these lessons forward and we live stream programs now where otherwise you'd have to be fully in person. Mm-hmm. We're able to do board meetings in a virtual and hybrid capacity. So it allows higher attendance and engagement, what have you.
So you were 6 months into your formal role when you had to close the museum. So while you were working with the museum, and we'll talk more about this in a little bit, as a consultant, you know, you weren't brand new, but you were new to your role. Since then, there's been significant change in the executive leadership team. And I think my understanding is you're now one of the longest standing members. How has that impacted your ability to get things done? And is newer better or worse? You know, how does that work?
I think you can look at change in many different ways, and change is inevitable, as we know. And so you can't use it as a scapegoat for chaos in
that
your
is
role
so
as
true.
A leader. Yeah. You know, right? Like this is always, there's always going to be a situation, and we're living through it right now with Richard having our museum director just having announced that in 2023, he will depart from his role as museum director. And my role as a member of the executive team, and also my role for my team, is to make sure that there's consistency, there's a plan, there's an understanding and expectations are set about the work that still needs to be done. We're not taking our foot off the gas. We still have priorities with Richard to realize. And the same has happened with different transitions of the executive leadership team. The biggest piece, as we know, is we've got to establish key relationships with these leaders because they're instrumental to our fundraising success. And so a big part of that has been establishing relationships, sharing the work of the department, building a culture of philanthropy, you know, through these significant leaders.
How do you do that? I mean, do you take people to coffee? Do you meet up after hours? How do you foster that?
Anytime we've had a new executive leader or any staff member that we work very closely with, is we want to get to know them. We want to know their thinking about the work that they're in charge of and overseeing. We don't expect them to have a strategy day one, but we want to understand their vision and the impact that they'd like to make in their role. And so I think, you know, at a high level, I always try to get to know, you know, colleagues and sort of understand how they want to interact, as well as the expectations that they might have of advancement. And the work that we're doing around fundraising. And then I think the biggest piece is just sharing the breadth of the work that our team oversees, understanding who they can go to for questions, who are key stakeholders, and then keeping communication open and not having everything always have to funnel through me. I think that's another big piece and is so key for people to understand is that success in fundraising and building this culture of philanthropy is not solely attributed to a strong chief advancement officer, but the collective team. And I'm recognizing that and building a system that allows your team to be most successful. And those internal relationships are so key. Building the internal relationships is just as paramount as building the external donor relationships, because we cannot do our jobs without, you know, having that as a team. And so we spend a lot of time talking about this idea of a culture of philanthropy and that our success really is the shared success of our colleagues across the institution and using the wins and broadcasting that and showing that and you know that success can sometimes help people come on board and want to be partners in ways that maybe they had, you know, hesitancies about prior.
So you've mentioned Richard a couple of times. How paramount has it been to have a close working relationship with him?
I mean, it's absolutely essential. And I would say that was one of the key reasons why I took this job is that I knew and I had seen in action that Richard is a true partner when it comes to advancements work. He dedicates the time to be with funders, to have conversations. He's constantly thinking with the lens of fundraising and how he can be supportive of our goals. And I would say there are very few leaders who have such superior relationship building skills that he does. And he's really a wonderful partner when it comes to thinking about new opportunities, thinking about how we're innovating and how we're being progressive in our fundraising. And he is also someone who's willing to learn from the team and really is very appreciative of the team's work, which I think is really instrumental from a leader.
Does he make asks?
He does. He does. And I think, you know, one of the things that I tried to work on is we were so heavily reliant on Richard when I first took this role that we really looked at how we're diversifying the number of people who are making these significant asks and can we include other relationship managers? And, you know, I think that will become really important as we're retaining donors at this moment through this leadership transition period. But he is not afraid to ask. And he's also not afraid to be a partner and to not ask when he is not needed to be in the room. And I think that's really critical is being able to understand shared responsibility here.
And you said Richard does think in an innovative, through an innovative lens. How are you thinking about innovating for the future? And I know you'd mentioned Abu Dhabi. What else is on the horizon?
The big project of Abu Dhabi, which we're looking at the structure of that organization once it's built is, you know, how structurally does the staffing model look and things like that. But I think, you know, the Guggenheim is known for being innovative. And I know that's a very buzzy word, but, you know, one of our core values is experimental and it's very much part of our ethos and our founding is that, you know, we were founded as a museum of non-objective art. And at the time it was a very risk-taking, radical idea. And I think that has really shaped so much of how the museum thinks.
So it's part of your origin story.
Exactly. And I think the other piece too is, you know, like I talked about, we're nimble enough to try things and to learn from them, what worked, what didn't work, and to be able to model those changes into the future. You know, we're going to be looking at our operating model, knowing what we've just experienced, and different revenue opportunities, whether that's an earned or contributed revenue. expanding remit of our team. I mean, even my own team has taken over new and expanding opportunities. My events team also oversees our film shoots and our, you know, licensed photo shoots. We see really innovative corporate engagement strategy coming out of our corporate and global partnerships program here at the museum. And we're really looking at trends, obviously, in philanthropy that really will inform how we focus and strategize moving forward. And then, you know, thinking about this digital piece, and we just finished a brand strategy exercise that I think will be helpful as well as we think about the Guggenheim as a whole moving forward.
I was surprised to learn that your offices are not in the museum. So that was already a factor before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm just curious to understand how you're handling these different locations and sites of offices on top of a hybrid culture post-pandemic for your team.
Frank Lloyd Wright did not imagine museum staff in the 300s when he built the museum. So we've already are multi-site, right? Both internationally and here in the city. So we have multiple sites. We have the museum uptown. We have our offices, administrative offices downtown. We have our conservation lab and sort of main collection storage area. And then we have various other facilities throughout the city. And so we've been in this multi-site capacity. And I think flexibility is key when we're thinking about hybrid culture. And one of the things that I think is important too is fundraisers, hopefully, have been having this hybrid culture even before the pandemic, right? Like this, you as a leader should ascribe to the idea that your frontline fundraisers aren't doing their jobs when they're glued to their laptops and computers. And I always really promoted the idea of people being out and about and meeting with donors. And now this is obviously different with Zoom and digital convenings. But I think, you know, that's always been something that's been very important for our field of work. And I find that expectation setting and really setting ground rules for this new modality of working, let's call it, is important. So leading with flexibility, leading with an understanding that people's lives have shifted and there's various responsibilities, but if you're getting your work done, you're getting your work done. Now, if you're not, and you're not meeting deadlines, that's where we're going to have a conversation about it. But I think setting those expectations is so key and critical.
And how do you do that? Like, do you do that in writing? Do you do that with regular meetings?
Yeah, I think it's done in, you know, the work product and however you're measuring that within your organization. Is your forecast that you're going to hit your budget? And is your forecast that your portfolio is going to perform in a way that we've budgeted and that we've expected? And have you made the number of solicitations that are expected? And are you meeting key deadlines for, you know, whether it's proposals being delivered, you know, grant deadlines, whatever the case might be? And are you reachable? Even if you're in a hybrid capacity, are you able to be communicated with? And right, there's all of these ways in which we can think about that. But I think in the hybrid culture, two of the biggest things that are really, really important is this idea of setting expectations. And if you don't set clear expectations, then that's really challenging. And then the other is communication and how you're choosing to communicate with your team. I have a team of 30 individuals, so we communicate in a variety of different forums, and there's a variety of ways in which we're information sharing that might be different than pre-pandemic. Challenges in communication and expectation setting have been certainly learnings for me as we navigate this hybrid workforce moving forward.
So how do you communicate beyond email?
Yep. So we have created core days. So we're bringing the team all together once a month to talk about really high level items. Whether
I like that name, core days.
Yeah. Yeah. I either heard it somewhere or we made it up, but we decided that, you know, collaboration is still very key for some of our work. And so if we could have a dedicated day where we're asking the team to come in, we have our staff meeting where we're able to communicate high level updates and sort of larger, you know, institution-wide projects, what have you. And then we do sort of a brainstorm inventory type strategic meeting and build some other convenience around that. But I found that that's a helpful way to communicate. Obviously, we use all of the technological tools to communicate. I also use my direct reports as a way of saying, okay, here's an update, please then disseminate this to your team, right? So we're thinking about information sharing in that capacity. And I think it's hard too, because I think there's also a real desire for transparency at this mm-hmm. moment in time, especially from leadership. Mm-hmm. And I think what I have tried to help create within my team is I will share things when and where I'm able to, but sometimes information isn't able to be shared because it's not final, or there's other things that, you know, prevent me from being able to share. It's not that I don't want to. And so trying to create an understanding of, I know you might have questions about X, Y, and Z. I acknowledge that. I hear that. I will come back to you with answers when and where I can. And that, so yeah. I think that acknowledgement, especially in a time where there's this deep desire for transparency across the board, can make it challenging for leaders to communicate in ways that staff desire.
Yeah. So people know you're not holding information and just sitting on it. As soon as you have it and can, they trust that you will.
Yeah, exactly.
I do think that's really important.
Exactly.
So we've talked high level about a little bit of what you've been through. We got a snapshot of the way you lead and the museum's leadership, but let's talk about your personal story, Leah. I mean, you came into this role in a really interesting way, and I found it so intriguing. Tell us about your journey and transition from being an assigned consultant to the museum to then being hired on as the chief advancement officer.
I've had great opportunities throughout my career to work for wonderful organizations as a frontline fundraiser, and then a wonderful opportunity to go work for CCS fundraising as a consultant, working with clients across sectors, across scale, across development initiatives, whether that be campaign related, what have you. And was lucky enough to begin my work with the museum in the early spring of 2016, related to an endowment initiative that had relatively stalled at the museum. And so we were brought in to sort of think about reimagining, re-strategizing, rebuilding, re-energizing, what have you, this campaign. And so I got to work with my predecessor at the time, Richard, the board, quite closely as we were really trying to build the endowment. We still are trying to build that here at the museum. We're under endowed for our budget size. And so that continues to be something we're looking at quite seriously. And so when the previous chief advancement officer left, Richard asked me as a consultant to serve as our interim chief advancement officer. And that began, I think, in February of 2019. And the idea was that I had no skin in the game, so to speak. You know, I didn't sit in one area or another where there would be preferential treatment. Not that that would have been the case with the staff here, but that I, you know, had the capacity to sort of think about things from a strategic standpoint. And I knew the museum and I knew what was ahead of us. And so, and had relationships as well.
So that felt natural.
It felt natural. And I was excited because it meant that, you know, I would still be able to work with the museum, and working very closely with the museum, obviously came to love the mission, the work, the stories that the museum has the opportunity to tell, the incredible staff that work here at the museum. And in the summer time, they were going through a search process. And I remember then the COO and Richard asking me if I would consider this role. At the time, I was getting ready for what was next in my consulting work. And, you know, my head was very much in the consulting sort of strategy side. And it was a moment where I went and I talked with my husband and I said, you know, I'm thinking about this pivot quite seriously. And here are the reasons why. Number one, I knew the organization. There are no skeletons in the closet, so to speak, right? Like, it was very clear.
You loved it.
I loved the work. I loved the board members that I worked with. I loved the staff. And so I decided to make a very difficult decision to leave CCS, a firm that I loved, and the partners that I worked with, I still adore to this day. And we still have a good relationship. And I think while it was unexpected, it was the right decision for that moment. And I have lived through some very challenging moments here at the museum, but I think professionally, it has really defined so much of who I am as a leader and who, you know, I would endeavor to be moving forward.
Had the thought crossed your mind before they came to you that this was something you might want?
You know, I thought about, do I want to go back in-house? Because I think I missed this like frontline sort of relationship with donors that you didn't have as a consultant. So in the back of my mind, I always thought, like, would I do that? What would be the time period? I was someone who, you can appreciate, Catherine, because I think you might be the same, where it was like, these are the goals that I have. This is what I want to build, the skill sets. And then I want to go on and do this. And as a consultant, I sort of got to this moment where I loved consulting and I wasn't quite sure what might be next for me. Mm-hmm. And I think, yes, maybe I thought about it quickly, but it wasn't until Richard, until I knew that I had the support of the director of the museum, that I seriously began to consider taking this role full time.
Did you ever doubt your ability to lead such a large team and on the earlier side of your career trajectory?
You know, I don't think I doubted it. I think I understood the significant shift that would occur from me being a peer to me being the leader. And there's, you know, if you've read management books, you know, there's theories and there are companies that will never kind of promote within peers to sort of leaders of those teams for a variety of functions. So I knew that was going to be a critical defining moment from my management side of things. I was able to navigate that. I didn't doubt the capacity for the work because I had built, you know, strategies for organizations similar to the Guggenheim and in other sectors and knew the philanthropic landscape really well. So I don't think that was necessarily what I was thinking about, but I was very, very conscious of how this would impact internal relationships.
Beyond the Guggenheim, you teach at Columbia University in the nonprofit management program. What prompted that? And that's a huge commitment that you've decided to take on in addition to your work. Tell us about your thought process there.
I know the important role that education has played in my life and what it's instilled in me. And I love that Columbia leads with this practitioner-led model. It's something that I would say is sort of my personal ethos is I'm going to teach my team the best practice strategies of fundraising, whether that be, you know, major gifts and principal level work, whether that be corporate engagement. But I'm also then going to talk about the real life scenario that we live in. You know, I think it's this marriage of both. And that's what I really love about teaching. And it keeps me on my A game. I learned so much from students and their perspectives. And I love being able to help support, you know, future leaders in the field. The program does a really great job of providing a strong foundation when it comes to sort of key skill sets that you need to be successful as a fundraiser or to work in the nonprofit industry overall.
Of course, everyone says it's a small world. Everyone knows each other. And then we come to find out someone on my team took your class during the summer session. What course was that you taught?
It was a major in leadership giving. So I teach two courses primarily. So the fundamentals of fundraising, which is your like fundraising 101. And then I get to teach my favorite course, which is an elective on major in leadership giving. And we'll soon add a campaign component to that class. So it'll be major leadership and campaign fundraising. So much of what every organization is thinking about right now is at this major principal leadership level giving. And I think sometimes as a young fundraiser or someone who's worked in the field for a long time, but maybe not in this area, it gives you the competencies to be able to talk about this work, even if you haven't done it in a frontline capacity. And I think that is a real strength.
So I'd heard about you, Leah, before I met you. It was Thomas Moore who said, you must meet Leah. We finally met in person at Fundraising Day in New York City. It was put on by AFP and it was wonderful to meet you. And I learned there that you're on the board of AFP. Why is that a priority for you? That's another huge commitment on top of your work.
Well, I'm so glad Thomas introduced us. Thomas is another great leader when you're thinking about philanthropy and fundraising overall. And now we share working in the arts and culture space together. And, you know, AFP, I think, is a priority and important to me because it's this idea of servant leadership in action too, right? Like it's something that's important to me. I'm passionate about the field. I want to support the profession and members who are in the field or desire to be in the field and really, you know, look at this as an opportunity to mentor as well as continue to learn. And I've really enjoyed being involved with professional advancement and fundraising day and putting together these learning opportunities.
Well, I just wanted to highlight it because not everyone does it, and it is on top of, and it obviously, I think it's important. I have a podcast, but you know, if people are listening and thinking, I have a big job, I'm pulled in a million directions, I just don't have time, I want them to hear you say you're making the time.
Yeah. And I think one of the things I'm learning more and more is how I'm prioritizing time and what's important and what, you know, provides fulfillment and joy in my work. And if that ever were to stop being the case, then I would think about, you know, other opportunities. But at this moment, it's important for me to be an advocate for the profession and for the field, and also to share a resource like AFP, who is out there for fundraising professionals, whether you be a fundraising shop of one or 1,000. Mm-hmm. There's a place for you and opportunities to learn via AFP.
So I was looking through your LinkedIn as I was preparing for this, and I was delighted to see that you went to Knox College in Illinois, which is a small liberal arts college that I knew about because my parents are from a very small town in Illinois. And I just want listeners to know that part of your story as well. And I was curious, I know you've moved around a bit, but was coming to New York City something that was on your mind as a young girl, or was this an unexpected pathway for you?
Like I said, I was raised in a family of academics, so I've always felt at home on college campuses, and my parents had mutual connections at the time to the then president and wife and his wife at Knox through some of their academic pursuits. And both my parents being Midwesterners said, won't you consider just looking at this school? I think it's a great fit. They were also huge proponents of a liberal arts education. I could get into a whole nother podcast about my support of the liberal arts and why I think it's a great foundation for anyone, you know, thinking about college. But my parents at the time were in Connecticut, and I realized being away from them for 4 years that I wanted to come back to the East Coast. I missed them. I loved being in the Midwest for school. And I was also very much, even though I chose to go to a very rural part of the country for college, I still very much loved city life, city experiences, what have you. And yeah. So my parents at the time were adamant I take a gap year. I was supposed to go to law school right from college, and that I take a gap year and go and work. And I ended up working in fundraising for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, and I loved it. And I then said, I'm not going to law school. This
oh my God.
Is the career that I'm going to choose. And I had the opportunity to work out of the New York office for St. Jude. And it was the best decision I made coming out of college, and happened through, you know, networking and relationships. And I think that's so key for any college students listening. It was very interesting how it all worked out. And I'm very grateful for my experience at St. Jude, and grateful that I'm now close to my family now that I'm in different stages of life. So it's all worked out.
Well, Leah, thank you so much for sharing so openly and talking with us. I would love to end with my signature question. What do you know for sure?
So I would say, and I love this question, I'm glad that this is your signature question. You know, fundraising has never been more critical to the health and success of any nonprofit organization than it is now. I think we've seen that in the past several years, as well as with the challenges that we're experiencing as a world right now, you know, however you define those challenges, and there are significant ones. And we have a great opportunity in front of us if we can harness and build true cultures of philanthropy within our organizations to really tackle pressing issues, as well as, you know, fill needs in society. And so I think that is something I know for sure to be true.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine. It's been a pleasure.
I hope Leah's story inspired you. She was open to her future, and it unfolded in a beautiful way because she trusted the timing of her life and was prepared to take on the present opportunity. This is the final episode of season 8. I will be taking a short break and would love to hear from you in the interim. Check out my LinkedIn page or the Instagram at devdebrief. I would love to hear how you are exploring being a circle in a world of squares and what thoughts and ideas this episode brought up for you. Up next, season 9.